Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
There's so much more to food than just eating it. There's emotions to it, and there's a story behind it, why you were craving it, why you cooked it.
Shelley Westerhausen is a foodie of many stripes. She writes a blog, she produces a magazine, she's working on a cookbook. We talked to her today about telling the story of our food lives through photos. How traditional farmers could help grow the cannabis industry from Harvest Public Media. Author Michael Farrell says it just makes sense that everyone with maple trees on their property would tap them for sap. Then what do you do with a bunch of used fry oil? Turn it into biodiesel, of course. And a recipe for salmon patties that passes the Lenten fish fry test. Recapping the week in food and agriculture headlines, here's Mark Chilla.
The U.S. Senate fell short of the votes needed to advance a bill that would override state GMO label laws. The bill would make GMO labels voluntary and preempt laws requiring labels like the one passed in Vermont. The federal bill's supporters are racing a deadline on July 1st, when Vermont's law is slated to go into effect. The bill needed 60 votes to move forward, but only got 49 votes in favor and 48 votes against. But it's not over yet. The committee's minority leader, Debbie Stabenow, said a deal on an amended version could be reached as early as next week. Then again, it could have to wait until after a two-week Easter recess. To win over more support, the bill's vanguard, Agriculture Committee Chairman Pat Roberts, is proposing an amendment that would mean companies would not be forced to disclose GMO ingredients unless voluntary labels fail to cover at least 70% of the food supply within 3 years. That's according to agriculture news site AgriPulse. U.S. meat processor Cargill says it will stop using antibiotics important for human medicine in about 18% of its cattle. The decision will affect a total of 1.2 million cattle per year at four U.S. feed yards from one of its suppliers. Cargill's president, John Keating, said in a release that the decision was based partly on rising demand for antibiotic-free meat. The move follows increasing pressure from public health advocates to end use of antibiotics for promoting growth. Widespread use can cause bacteria to develop immunity. The U.S. Food and Agriculture Administration released voluntary guidelines in 2013 to reduce non-medical antibiotics use in livestock, with a goal set for December 2016. Hog farmers, still battling a disease that caused over $1 billion in damage, are coming to better understand how the virus arrived in North America. Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer has more.
The porcine epidemic diarrhea, or PED, outbreak began in spring 2013, and evidence suggests the virus originated in China. Its global spread was a mystery, but some veterinarians saw a possible link to feed. Now, researcher Scott D. says he's shown imported ingredients may have given the virus a ride here from China.
Contaminated feed ingredients, if they're the right ones, could have certainly supported virus survival throughout this entire 37-day trip.
Dee says he hopes his findings will lead to more research on animal diseases that have not yet arrived here from other continents. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And animal welfare and food safety advocates are taking a page out of the fossil fuel divestment movement playbook. Instead of targeting factory farm companies themselves, groups like Share Action and the Farm Animal Investment Risk and Return Initiative are leaning on global investors who support factory farming through companies in which they hold stocks or companies that purchase animal products. And according to a recent article in The Guardian, some think this is the key to large-scale change in the factory farm industry. So far, it's not clear how many investors are actively divesting from factory farming. A list of these articles has been compiled in the podcast post on our website. Read them, share them, and be sure to tag us, eartheats.org.
Then there's the Twitter, where we post stories 24/7 at Earth Eats. Mark, till next time.
Have a good one.
Cannabis cultivation is moving from darkened basements into well-lit grow houses, even farm fields. As more states legalize the growth of marijuana or hemp, growers are turning to traditional farmers for help in turning cannabis into the next big American commodity. From Colorado, Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports.
The Governor's Forum on Agriculture in Denver is your typical farm conference. Every year, farmers in denim and bolo ties mingle with ag professionals. The governor himself swings by for a keynote speech. But this year, there was a new addition.
I'd like to thank everybody for showing up to the Cannabis and Emerging Crop of Colorado panel.
Cannabis, an emerging crop of Colorado. In years past, marijuana growers haven't been invited to the event. Now, Duane Sinning, the state regulator in charge of industrial hemp, is introducing three cannabis company executives.
There's an opportunity where traditional agriculture can help an industry emerge in this state.
Because cannabis is the state's newest and flashiest cash crop, there's a focus on finding the best and most efficient ways to grow it, to turn cannabis into a full-blown commodity, like wheat or corn. Brooke Gehring sat on the panel. She's the CEO of a chain of cannabis shops in the Denver metro area called Live Green.
Farmers understand scale. They understand hardship. They understand that you're only as good as your last crop, but how can you be more efficient?
This is basically the brain of our company right here.
Stephen Lipton knows those lessons. He's the cultivation manager at The Farm, a recreational and medical marijuana operation in Boulder, Colorado. Before growing commercial-scale cannabis, Lipton worked as an organic farmer. We're in his research lab, a room filled with at least 150 different strains of marijuana planted in small pots.
Genetics is really the cornerstone of the whole thing, in my opinion. You know, I mean, without that, you know, you really have nothing.
Just like a plant breeder attempting to make a sweeter apple or a heartier tomato, he crosses strains in search of the perfect variety.
Plant vigor, smell, aroma, taste, yeah. Anything that you can really imagine. Yield is a big one for sure.
Most of modern agriculture relies heavily on inputs, like fertilizers and pesticides, to keep plants healthy and productive. But for obvious legal reasons, the Monsantos and John Deeres of the world aren't catering to cannabis growers. That leaves room for startups.
How's it going, Colin?
Good. Yeah.
Nice to meet you.
It's very nice to meet you. Come on in.
Thanks.
Colin Bell decided to use his knowledge of soil microbes to serve the marijuana sector. Bell originally developed a soil additive for vegetable crops at Colorado State University, but now sells beneficial bacteria by the gallon to marijuana growers under the brand name Mammoth.
You know, we hear bigger flowers, we hear denser flowers, which actually, in the end, it translates to more yield, right?
And more yield translates to more money. In Colorado alone, marijuana sales were just shy of $1 billion in 2015. And more markets are coming online. More than 20 states have laws allowing industrial hemp and medical marijuana, and 4 states, plus Washington, D.C., give permission for recreational use of the drug. With a handful of states expected to fully legalize this year, Bell says a lot of farmers want in on the ground floor.
It's a super exciting opportunity from a business perspective. You know, there hasn't been a new market in many, many, many years, and there might not be one again in our lifetime.
That same excitement is on display back at the Governor's Forum on Agriculture in Denver. Grant Mativi farms potatoes and barley in the state's parched San Luis Valley. Last season, he gave hemp a try. In a region prone to drought, he likes the crop's ability to withstand dry conditions.
I just think that to be successful and to get this industry really going on its feet, that we need to involve farmers a little bit more rather than basement weed growers.
At first, Mativi says he was skeptical about jumping onto the bandwagon in the rush to grow cannabis. Now, he says he just needs to figure out how to run his combine over it. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Later today, turning a waste product from the kitchen into energy, a story from a Lenten fish fry. The magazine Bon Appetit published its first ever culture issue in March. It presented stories about how food intersects with entertainment and politics. Great stories. But the gimmick was really in how they presented their photos. Most of the images were snapped with a smartphone, a fun challenge for their professional photographers. I tasked a local photographer with the same challenge in the hopes we'd learn some tricks for the next time we wanted to share pictures of our hamburger and fries on Instagram.
Let's try it right here.
Shelley Westerhausen writes the blog Vegetarian Ventures. So I guess change that to black bean burger and fries.
Do you mind if I take a photo?
Oh, that's fine.
Okay, thank you.
Rule number one, says Westerhausen, always ask before you take someone's picture. We met up at the Winter Farmers Market on an especially bustling Saturday morning. She's got her iPhone 6 in hand instead of her digital SLR camera. She was first drawn to the hydroponically grown greens at the Good Life Farms table.
I love all the root texture here. This would make a really great photo. And then if it's an Instagram shot, you have to get your feet in it because that's just part of the culture.
Okay. To show, like, I was there.
Yeah, exactly. To make you feel like you're in the photo.
So you're looking for texture. That's
the main thing. Another thing you look for is color, but this time of year, you're not going to get nearly as much vibrance.
There's more going on here than just pictures. Westerhausen looks for inspiration in produce when she's developing new recipes for her blog. She would pair those greens with some roasted winter squash and rosemary.
Cool.
Rule number two, raw salads are always beautiful to photograph.
Ooh, yeah. I'm going to buy some microgreens because I love microgreens and I cannot find them at the store.
Morning. Hello.
Can I get a thing of this one?
Right on time. I've got two spices left.
Awesome.
That'd be $3.
Cool.
Search her blog and you'll see basil microgreens on top of a strawberry chocolate tart. The picture shows the dessert on top of a piece of wax paper like it's fresh out of the oven. The delicate microgreens are piled on top of bright, red, plump strawberries. Then scroll down to the recipe, and it's really straightforward. Goat cheese, yogurt, maple syrup for the filling. And for the crust, it's flour, salt, cocoa powder, more maple syrup, and coconut oil. From her perspective, how the photos look is actually more important than how the recipe reads.
There's just so much out there. Blogs are so big right now. You know, there's so many websites that focus on recipes that there's so much competition that if your photo doesn't stand out because it's the first thing someone sees when they open up a webpage or open up a magazine, they're not going to spend the time on it.
She started Vegetarian Ventures 6 years ago to record her successes and failures with vegetarian cooking. As she got better at improvising recipes, she realized she needed to also become better at capturing images of the finished dishes.
I remember the first time I made chili with one of my best friends in college, and I was just like, this is amazing. Like, I didn't know I could do this. Like, I didn't know it was possible as a new cook. And then I took a photo of it, and it looked disgusting. It was brown, and there were mushy beans in there. And so from there, it kind of was like, I want to figure out ways to let people know how delicious this food is by showing them how beautiful it is.
Now she collaborates with companies to develop recipes. For instance, Southern Indiana Microgreens could hire Westerhausen to create a recipe using their products. She would take pictures of it and post it on her website. Her latest project is the independent magazine Driftless, which celebrates food, art, and life in the Midwest. In the spread about brunch recipes, we see a picture of the spring quiche she made. Still on the cutting board with shards of ramps scattered around it. It says handmade and freshly cooked and seasonal.
For me, a big part of photography is not only capturing the food, but capturing a mood with it and capturing the aesthetic, just because there's so much more to food than just eating it. There's emotions to it, and there's a story behind it, why you were craving it, why you cooked it.
That's probably her rule number three. Tell a story with your photos.
Do you mind if I take a photo?
This is maybe the most colorful table. Beets, yeah. Carrots, rainbow chard.
Yeah, this rainbow chard is gorgeous. Let's try and get a shot of that.
Back at the market, she says her shopping habits have changed since she's become serious about photography.
I have this vegetable soup recipe that where you just throw it in at the end, so it's just a little bit crunchy. It's very, very good.
Rainbow chard, grown by a local farmer, purchased at the farmer's market, tells a better story and makes a better recipe. Shelley Westerhausen is one of the creative directors of Driftless. Her blog is at vegetarianventures.com, and she's also working on her first cookbook, The Trifecta. Be sure to visit our website to see her photos, eartheats.org. This year's sugaring season may already be over, but Michael Farrell is here to make the case for tapping your backyard maple trees next year. Then,
the idea is to have a nice, moist final croquette so that it's crispy on the outside, but creamy and fluffy on the inside.
Bob Adkins with tips and tricks and some beautifully cooked salmon. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome back. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. For Michael Farrell, it all started with taste.
Well, what got me hooked on sugaring was when I went to the pancake breakfast at my college forest, Sugarbush, when I was studying forestry in grad school.
That was the first time he tried real maple syrup.
And it was just one of those enlightening moments. I had always had the artificial pancake syrup before then. And once I had tried it, I was hooked right away.
Farrell then did what most of us don't do, which is he tried making it himself. That's called sugaring. Like most DIY projects, it took a while for him to learn how to do it.
Screwed up a lot. It's hard to do it right. Eventually got it right, but in the meantime, I decided to just drink a lot of sap, and that's what I really loved.
The sap can be enjoyed straight out of the tree.
A lot of sugar makers drink sap as a seasonal beverage. I'm a huge sap drinker myself, and it tastes basically like water with just a hint of sweetness to it. Remember, there's only 2% sugar in it, and because there's so many minerals in it, it also has a distinct flavor as well.
Farrell is also the author of The Sugar Maker's Companion. The book aims to encourage all of us, at least anyone with trees on their property, to start sugaring or collecting sap. He says it's a way to return to our roots. The indigenous peoples of southeastern Canada and northeastern U.S. had collected sap and boiled it past syrup down to sugar. It was easier to store that way. European settlers then picked up the practice. Various technological advancements were made over the years, including the spout or spile in the early to mid-1800s. That was a way to collect sap without damaging the tree. In 1860, Americans had produced 40 million pounds of maple sugar and 1.6 million gallons of maple syrup, the most up to that point. But 25 years later, cane sugar became a viable alternative to the labor-intensive process of sugaring.
Once cane sugar became much cheaper, people stopped producing so much maple sugar because economically it didn't pay for them to do so.
Many producers switched to syrup instead, and now we see plastic tubing that helps get the sap from the trees to plastic tubs. A process called reverse osmosis removes 3/4 of the water from the sap, which makes it much quicker to boil it down to syrup. But Farrell says you don't need all this fancy technology to do this yourself. All it takes is a handful of trees and some patience.
I do think we should get back to the point, as we did back in the 1800s, where most people tap their trees to collect sap and to make sugar in the springtime. We produced a far greater amount of maple sugar back in the 1800s than we do today. Yet today we have a lot more maple trees, and there's no reason why we can't produce and consume just as much maple sugar as we did back when people were really living off the land.
Michael Farrell can tell you so much more about starting your own mini maple farm in your backyard. His book is The Sugar Maker's Companion. During the season of Lent, many Catholics don't eat meat on Fridays. But fish is considered fair game, so the Friday night fish fry has become an annual tradition. All of that frying oil can just go to waste, but Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach caught up with a few people putting it to good use.
Friday night in March means it's time for a fish fry at North American Martyrs, a Catholic church in Lincoln, Nebraska. I load up a plate with coleslaw, french fries, and of course, a pair of golden fried fish fillets.
All right, I'll have fried.
You have fried. How many would you like?
Two.
Behind the church, a group of volunteers work under a tent set up with four deep fryers and country music on the radio. Greg Helbush and his crew will churn out more than 200 pounds of fish for the 800 people who eat here tonight.
Take the fish out, put it in a pan to take inside for serving. Now we put five more pounds of fish in the baskets and drop it in the oil.
This is Friday night for 6 weeks, all through the Lenten season.
Bob D. helps organize the fish fry fundraiser. When all the frying is done this season, he says the church will be left with about 150 gallons of oil to dispose of.
What we do with that is, of course, use it for the fryers throughout the evening, and then we put it into a container. But anyway, that gentleman comes by, and he doesn't charge us anything for it. He just picks it up.
That gentleman D. is talking about is Leroy Forbes.
And, yeah, this is right out of the fryers from tonight.
Late Friday night, after the fish is all fried, Forbes comes to North American Martyrs to haul the used fry oil to his garage, where he turns it into biodiesel. Forbes backs up his pickup to a barrel filled with used oil. Then he dips in a wand connected to a hose.
Then what I have is it's a small block Chevy oil pump that's mounted to a 110-volt electric pump.
The pump fills a barrel in the back of his truck with the steaming hot oil.
Suck it up from one barrel into the other barrel, because when these things are full, they weigh more than what I can lift.
Forbes has been making his own biodiesel in his garage for 3 years. He doesn't sell it. He uses it in the summer to fuel his own diesel truck and a Volkswagen Beetle with a diesel engine.
15 to 20 gallons in what? 4 minutes?
Forbes taught himself how to make biodiesel with help from a neighbor who had experience. He says it's not rocket science, but it is chemistry. Take vegetable oil, add heat, methanol, and a chemical catalyst.
What I basically do is strip the glycerin molecule off of the triglycerides, and I put a methanol in there and make, I believe it's called methyl esters, and that's where you get the biofuel.
Each Friday night during Lent, Forbes gathers oil from four fish fries in Lincoln. It may be more work than it's worth financially, but he enjoys the hobby, and by Easter, he'll have enough oil to run his truck all summer.
I'm guessing right around about 500 gallons. This is really a blessing. I like this.
In Omaha, Eric Williams' biodiesel hobby is about more than homemade fuel. Williams and his brother Scott created the Omaha Biofuels Co-op. Along with the 12 co-op members, they recycle about 6,000 gallons of oil each year.
We've got a big problem with CO2 and other pollutants in the air, and so whatever we can do to reclaim this resource and put it to its highest possible use, that was why the co-op was started, and that's what we want to continue to do.
The co-op collects from 25 restaurants around the city, but also gathers about 1,000 gallons of fry oil from churches just during Lent. Places like Mary Our Queen Catholic Church, where Williams is swapping out full oil barrels for empty ones. Williams says many big chain restaurants recycle their oil with commercial collection companies, but small restaurants and churches may send it to the landfill.
One, you're paying for the weight of the trash that's being disposed of, and two, you really shouldn't be doing that because it can be a biocontaminant in the trash.
Biodiesel is a way to turn that trash into fuel, and by the time the fish fries of Lent come around again next year, it'll be time to refill. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
Telling the stories from America's food landscape. HarvestPublicMedia.org. Seems about right to feature a fish recipe now. We'll be frying it, yes, but later on in the process. First, the salmon gets poached, then combined with a bunch of other goodies, and then fried into croquettes. That's what Chef Bob Atkins is calling this dish.
So it's a three-step process. First thing we're going to do is we're going to poach the salmon in a kind of a wide, shallow pan. To this, we're going to add a half gallon of water. To that half gallon of water, we're going to add some white miso paste. We are boiling, and so immediately after it boils, bring it down to a simmer because I don't want it to. I don't like to boil things. Really, only two things you should boil are green vegetables and pastas. Outside of that, everything else is done at a simmer. We're gonna add our salmon. It's been deboned. The skin is still on it. I could skin it, but there's really no need to take the skin off. There's a lot of flavor in the skin. So for about 3 minutes, they've been simmering on one side. We're going to let this go about another 3 to 4 minutes. And then we're going to turn the heat off, let them rest in the liquid. That'll finish that last bit of cooking, that carryover heat. But also it allows it to absorb the moisture and the flavor from the miso broth that is going to give you a nice, moist, and flavorful final product.
Save the miso broth. In case you need an extra dash of liquid, you can always throw some of that in.
So I have here approximately 10 to 12 cups of cooked rice. To that, we're going to add our salmon in a minute. But first, we're going to add our complementary ingredients to the rice. So have here a good amount of garlic, the red chili flakes, fresh chopped dill. To this, we're going to add half cup of toasted sesame seed and then sesame oil. It's going to add some fat to it. It's going to add some luxuriousness to it. And also a nice sesame oil. It just fills up with aroma. So with the dill and the sesame and the garlic and the miso, lots of really nice bright aroma going on. So we have all this here. You could use a spatula. I'm going to use some rubber gloves. And I'm really not crushing anything. I'm really trying to separate the grains of rice here. And now we have nice poached salmon. And it's still just a nice medium on the inside. And just very kind of gingerly fold the rice around the salmon, breaking up the bigger chunks as I go along, but not too much. At this point, we've got a big bowl of salmon and sticky rice. I'm just now forming it into little balls, and I'm going to flatten them out into kind of a disc or lentil type shape. The idea is to have a nice, moist, final croquette so that it's crispy on the outside, but creamy and fluffy on the inside. That's why we left the rice in the water to absorb it. That's why we left the salmon in the liquid to absorb that liquid.
Now for the frying. You don't have a restaurant-grade fryer. Grab a cast iron skillet and fill it 3/4 of the way full with oil. Fry these little discs for a few minutes on each side.
So I'm just going to gingerly remove these. I'm just going to drain them for a second on some paper towels. And then we've made a glaze out of sweet soy sauce, which is a thickened soy sauce, wasabi paste, some miso, nice thick pungent sauce to finish. Then a little toasted sesame seed over the top. And that's the salmon croquettes. Get them while they're hot and enjoy.
On the website, you'll see these served with a simple salad of bok choy, salt, and lime juice. Thank you to Chef Bob Atkins for making this. The recipe's at eartheats.org. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated. Now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington, independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Good stuff. Glad to have been with you today for Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.